ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय 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 प्रीति संदर्भ In Priti Sandarbha, Srila Jiva Goswami examines verse 7 of this chapter. Consult Srila Prabhupada's purport to verse 7. Anucheda 36. It is said in Srimad Bhagavatam 2.17, O King Parikit, mainly the topmost transcendentalists who are above the regulative principles and restrictions take pleasure in describing the glories of the Lord. In these words, the devotional service performed by the great souls is described. Position of non-devotees is criticized in these words of Srimad Bhagavatam 2.3.24. Certainly that hard as steel frame which in spite of one's hearing or in spite of one's chanting the holy name of the Lord with concentration does not change when ecstasy takes place. Tears fill the eyes and hairs stand on end. So your point, topmost transcendental is beyond the regulative principles and restrictions is because they're already doing what they're supposed to do, so there's no interest to do anything else. Right? It's not that they want to do, but now they don't have to follow the rules. You know what I'm saying? Just like, let's say, on a small child, we might have a restriction, you can't, when you're playing in the backyard, eat mud. Right? So is that restriction there for the adults? No. So that's the point. There's no interest, no need. So it's not, it's for us it looks like no restrictions, no this, but for them they're already just doing what they're supposed to be doing. Does that make sense? You know, the kid will say, oh, the adults can do whatever they want, they're free, they're... No, but it's because the adults are doing what they should be doing. That's why there's no rules. Does that make sense? Yeah. So the whole point is if we just voluntarily take up doing what we're supposed to do, then that's nice. Because what we're supposed to do is what pleases Krishna. Right? And if we please Krishna, we're pleased. So actually, what we're just being asked to do is do what is actually good for yourself. Right? Even if we want to look at it from a self-centered perspective, then this is actually what's good for you anyway. Does that make sense? In Krishna Sandarbha, Srila Jiva Goswami explains that the Bhagavatam means by the word kalpana, imaginary, in reference to the universal form. Here Bhagavatam 2.1.26 is examined. Consult Srila Prabhupada's purports to verses 20 through 23, 24 and through 26, 29 through 33, and 37 through 39. 1. To describe how the second Purusha incarnation, Nimisha, the second Purusha is Garbhodakshaya Vishnu. He is the aspect of Lord Prajumna, one of the Vaikuntha Chaturvyuha deities. The Chaturvyuha is Vasudev, Sankarshan, Prajumna, and Aniruddha, arrayed on four sides like a square around Mahanarayan. To describe how the second Purusha incarnation arranges the activities of the secondary phase of creation within each universe, Suta Goswami speaks the next 1.5 verses. Bhagavatam 1.3.2.3. A part of the Purusha lies down within the water of the universe engaged in Yoga Nidra. From the Neva lake of his body sprouts a lotus stem, and from the lotus flower atop this stem, Brahma, the master of all engineers in the universe, becomes manifest. It is believed that all the universal planetary systems are situated on the extensive body of the Purusha. Nimisha, meditation is a kind of sleep sense in both. One is unconscious of external world. 3. This verse describes how the second Purusha incarnation, Garbhodakshaya Vishnu, enters the universes and lies down Shayanasya on the Garbhodak Osha, Ambhasi. In these verses, the words Shayanasya, resting, and Avavya, Samstanai, situated on the limbs of his transcendental form, show that the transcendental feet and other limbs of the Lord were spread throughout the material universe. Because of this entrance of the Lord into the universe, it is sometimes considered that the entire universe is the body of the Lord, Virat Rup. Nimisha, Phraseology like "it is believed," "sometimes considered," and "the conception of the universal form" suggests imagination at work. 5. The entrance of the transcendental Lord within the material world, universe, is the cause of the universe's taking shape, as it were, his own form. The resultant Virat Rup, universal form of the Lord, is described in Srimad Bhagavatam 2.126. Persons who have studied it have realized that the planets known as Patal constitute the bottoms of the feet of the universal form, and the heels and the toes are the Rasatala planets. The ankles are the Mahatala planets, and the shanks considered the Talatal planets. Neophyte devotees can gradually fix their minds on the Lord's original form after practicing meditation upon the Virat Rup. The universal form is not actually real, it is an imagination. Nimisha. Next, Srila Jiva Goswami presents another way of understanding the Kalpana factor. The universe is that these potencies come from the universal form. It means everything's coming from the Lord, so here it's being described what part of his, you know, his person that these aspects manifest from. Does that make sense? So in this way, then you can say it's the form of the Lord. Does that make sense? But it's an imagined form because actually it's the external energy that these potencies enter into. So it's not exactly him. Right? Because it has to be imagined that it's him, because you see a pillar and then you have to imagine that potency to hold up or things like that. Does that make sense? Right? It means like Krishna's legs hold up the body, right? So that kind of potency is in these columns because it holds up. So you have to, through imagination here means through the mind. It's perceived through the mind. It doesn't mean it's not real, but it means it's perceived through the mind. But it's not real in that this is directly the Lord in that form. But his potency of his body is in this. But at the same time, as it is his external energy, so you can say it's his. But it's his external energy, not a form of himself. Does that make sense? So what you're taking is these overlapping definitions. So they're useful in that we have material perception, so we're trying to connect that perception to Krishna. So in that way, it's very useful. But at the same time, is we're trying to actually get to worshipping his eternal form as Shyama Sundar. Therefore, it has its limitations. Does that make sense? So it has that overlapping definition means it's useful, but, you know, so it is the Lord, but at the same time, it's not ultimately useful because it's not the form of the Lord that you want to be actually absorbed in. Does that make sense? We should be absorbed in thinking of the threefold bending form of Shyama Sundar. So when we are great, but when we're not, we're absorbed in the material energy, right? So how to get from the material energy to Krishna, right? So it's just a matter, okay, I stop thinking about the material energy, I start thinking about Krishna. If you can do that directly, or how much you can do that should be done, because that's direct. But that which the absorption of material energy takes up our attention, and we're not actually able to give up that thought, then the trick is then you see Krishna in that thing that's actually making you forget Krishna. Does that make sense? So that's the use of the universal form. Right? Then after that, then we move into, since you've gotten from the material energy, seeing that actually what's attractive about it is Krishna, then if this is only a fraction of his splendor, and it catches our attention so much, how much more will be the person who it's actually coming from? Does that make sense? So it's like a step in between. Does that make sense? You know? Okay, another way of understanding the Kalpana factor. The universal form may also be understood in the following way. Because the different varieties of the material manifestations emanate from the different limbs of the Lord's form, the universe may be considered a form of the Lord. This is confirmed in the Vedic hymns. Nimisha. In Srila Jiva Goswami's first explanation, the universe is presented as an aspect or part of Lord Gaura Daksha Vishnu. To take the aspect apart to be the Lord Himself is to conceive the universe as the Supreme Being by imagination. In Bhagavatam 2.1.21 purport, Srila Prabhupada calls the method indirect. One who practices this indirect method may be able to generate from his mind an imagination that he thinks is the deity. Such imaginary is pantheistic, speculation. It is artificially constructed from a poor fund of knowledge. For example, how can a pantheist, adhering as he does to a doctrine that demands he accept anything and everything as the absolute truth, grasp the factual difference between matter and spirit? His mind is too busy trying to convert all that he perceives through his imperfect senses into divinity. Jiva Goswami's second explanation is that the universe comes from no one less than the Lord Himself. To constantly remember, in other words, you're so much into the energy, it's the nature itself, then you're trying to see the Lord in it. But here you could possibly make a distinction that you understand there's a supreme potency there, but you haven't actually got to the person themselves. So make it, you know, it's just like, probably gives the example of the Aborigines. They see a big mountain, you know, or a monstrous pebble out in the middle of a desert, you know. And that for them is God, because it's something great and special, or a lightning bolt is something special. But so that's God, but they don't actually know the personal form of God. Like that. So they're understanding that aspect, but it has its limits. So the next stage, we understand that it's actually the Lord's form because He has entered it, but He is the person, and what aspects of His person are in that particular form. Does that make sense?
Jiva Goswami's second explanation is that the universe comes from no one less than the Lord Himself. To constantly remember Krishna as the source of everything, that He is to always be in devotional touch with Him. This is understood from Bhagavad Gita 10.8. Why is the first sense of kalpana indirect, and the second direct? It all comes down to one word, love. Srila Prabhupada states in The Path of Perfection, Chapter 6. If you love your child and your child is away, you think of him when you see his shoes. You think, oh, this is my dear child's shoes. It is not that you love the shoe, but the child. The shoe, however, evokes that love. Similarly, as soon as we see Krishna's energy manifested in a living entity, we love that entity because we love Krishna. Therefore, if we love Krishna, universal love is accounted for. Otherwise, universal love is nonsensical, because it is not possible to love everyone without loving Krishna. If we love Krishna, universal love is automatically there. Jiva Goswami continues, point 6. The moon is born from the mind of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Rigveda 10.9.13. The Supreme Personality of Godhead created the earth from His two lotus feet. He created the different directions from His sense of hearing. He created the different parts of the material world from the parts of His transcendental body.
So, in other words, you're seeing this potency, but if that evokes remembrance of Krishna, this is the direct method. You know what I'm saying? So this is the difference between the when we see that it's described that for the Mayavadis, it's speculation, it's imaginary, or for these pantheists, and then for the devotee, where it becomes something very useful in devotional service. It's the technical point of Uddipan, which is Vibhava, a stage of an item reminds you of the person you have affection for. Right? Probably gives an example, the mother sees the shoes of the child, she remembers the child. So the shoe invokes that. But it's part of the child's paraphernalia. So the Lord has expanded into this, but so you can appreciate either just the potency of the Lord, the impersonal aspect, just the power of God, or it will remind you actually of that person themselves. Does that make sense? So the direct is actually what's recommended for the devotees. The indirect is all right if someone's not a devotee, because at least they're connecting to the superiority of transcendence over matter, though it'll be actually very hard for them to actually tell the difference. Does that make sense? They'll make the mistake that the matter is divine. Yes.
What I'm saying is the potency of Krishna that is in everything.
How can we understand He's entered into every atom?
Because the
because he's there.
It's made up of many.
Yeah, but it doesn't mean he can't go inside that. That means there's an atom there, and so Krishna goes inside the atom. Still, that doesn't mean we won't see. It's like Paramatma's in your heart, right? Isn't it? But still, the body is gross matter. So in the same way, he can enter into the atom. Right?
It's not that he's dead.
Huh?
He can enter, but it's not that he's dead, or he can enter any time he likes.
No, he's there. He's always there. Means he's in every atom, he's between every atom. Means he's in the atom, therefore the atom functions, right? The atom is active, right? And at the same time as those atoms have to be held together, so he's between them also. So in that way he's pervaded everything. So you can see that way, you can see the potency, the specific potency that's there in that pillar. You know, does that make sense? So you have, like this, there's so many varieties of ways you can see. But Jiva Gosai is pointing out the difference between the direct and indirect. It means that when you see it, you see the person. Indirect means you just only see the potency, but that potency doesn't remind you of the person. Is that okay? Okay, point seven. In the Mahabharata, the Moksha Dharma, Narayaniya, Shantaparva 3.3.9.12.14, Lord Gaudakshaya Vishnu in his form as the master of Swetadvipa confirms this explanation in the following verses. 8. For my fourth expansion, the eternal form of Lord Sesha is manifest. When Lord Sankarshan is manifested from him, Lord Prajumna appears. From my appearance as Lord Prajumna, I again appear as Lord Aniruddha. From the lotus flower of Lord Aniruddha's navel, Brahma is born. And from Brahma, all the material elements, as well as the moving and non-moving living entities, appear. So he's pointing out this, how it's from him everything is appearing. Right? Here. Also, and here we see is that some there's a difference in how you approach the Chaturvyuha. Because it's depending upon what you want to establish, right? You have your general definition, but then you have special ways of looking at it also. Does that make sense? Because everything has multiple aspects. You know, there's a generalized definition, but then there's various aspects within that. And those aspects themselves will be divided down into these different parts. Does that make sense? Like your prayojana, this Aniruddha, means the result, but it also means the desire to get the result, or the, let's say, the need to get that result, right? And Prajumna is the desire to have that result. Does that make sense? So, because in Prajumna you're actually would be thinking of the result, then you could say that aspect is Aniruddha. Does that make sense? So depending on how fine or specific you want to get, there's a general definition like Mahavishnu. But then Mahavishnu, his meditation is, identity is, I am the creator, the maintainer, and the destroyer. So those are three separate aspects. So as creator, that's Hiranyagarbha, that's Brahma. As destroyer, that's Sadashiva. That's why you can say Mahavishnu is Sadashiva, because it's one of his ways of identifying himself. Right? Like, that's different than Krishna and Vaikuntha. Krishna and Vaikuntha, he sees himself, I am God. Right? So there's no creator, there's no destroyer, because Vaikuntha is eternal. Does that make sense? So he's just God, he's Vishnu. But Sankarshan, I mean, Mahavishnu has this element of tamasi, where the destructive element is there. Because that's the point, the temporariness of this material world is what makes it different. Right? You can say that the Vaikuntha planets are eternally expanding, so you could in one sense say there's a creation. But it's just expanded. It's not like this is a whole mechanical creation. But destruction is never there. So the unique, the actual, you could say, the root uniqueness in the material world is its temporariness, right? As opposed to its eternality. So then he's known as Tamasi. So you generally hear Mahavishnu referred to as Sadashiva, not as Hiranyagarbha. You'll say he's the creator, but you always think of him as Vishnu, right? Vishnu the maintainer, Vishnu the creator. He is the destroyer, but in that form of destruction, that's what Shiva does. Does that make sense? So a slight subtlety there. Right? So, in that, then, in the same way as you could say Prajumna is Aniruddha, because Prajumna means the desire to be involved with the field, but that means the desire to get that result. That result is what you would like. It hasn't become a need, but it's what you're meditating on. So because of that focus, you can say they are that. Right? Lord Chaitanya, Krishna is focusing or meditating upon the mood of Radharani, so he becomes Lord Chaitanya. So we say he is Radharani. Right? At the same time, he's Krishna. Does that make sense? So in the same way, according to this... Good morning, sir.
Yeah, according to this clock... Me and David talk too much, that's all. Easily been here. Either. We just yap way too much.
According to this clock. So should we chastise the clock for...
No.
Okay. So does that make sense? Because otherwise one would say, so we've just spent this whole so many pages defining Garbhodakshay Vishnu as Prajumna. And now here, from his own mouth, then Krishna himself, Garbhodakshay Vishnu himself, is saying the lotus flower is coming out of the navel of Aniruddha. Right? So in other words, the connection is there. Prajumna means there is a meditation on Aniruddha. Right? Because Prajumna is Aniruddha is the next expansion. Does that make sense? Yes, no? Yeah. So it's just so that one is not confused. Nimesha, the goal of the Bhagavat Shankya philosophy taught by Devahuti Sutta Kapila, not the atheist Kapila, as well as the mystic yoga system, is Paramatma Darshana. Vedivyasa then explains, they who are learned in Shankya Yoga declare that Lord Aniruddha is the all-pervading Supersoul. Lord Shankarshan's transcendental deeds have expanded his reputation as the Supreme Personality of Godhead. The wise know that the unmanifest origins, pradhan, of material creation have emanated from Lord Shankarshan, and because of him, this original form of matter evolves into the manifest material world. Lord Aniruddha, the all-pervading Supersoul present in each universe, appears from Lord Shankarshan, and he creates Brahma, the grandfather of all living entities. The first part of the ten. The first part of this passage describes the glories and activities of Lord Shankarshan, and the second part, beginning with the words Aniruddha He, describes the glories and activities of Lord Aniruddha, Nimisha, Kirudaksha, Vishnu. The word Lokeshu means in each universe, and the word Mahatma means the all-pervading Supersoul, Paramatma. The word Vyaktatvam means manifested from Lord Prajumna, Nimisha, Prajumna, Garbhodakshay Vishnu. The rest of the universe is clear and requires no comment. Nimisha. In summary, Srila Jiva Goswami shows us that the different Vishnu Tattva forms are non-different, but they are not one. When we read that Brahma is created by this Vishnu or that, we should understand that such passages are to be different ways of saying the same thing. In the final analysis, it is just as valid to say that Sri Krishna's expansions create the universe as it is to say that Krishna is the source of all. In either case, Prajumna, whose aspect is Garbhodaksha Vishnu, is expanded from Mula of Shankarshan, and so is Aniruddha, the Lord of the Heart. Be that as it may, Prajumna is still father of Brahma. 11. Because Sutta Goswami wanted to emphasize that all Vishnu forms are exactly the same single personality of Godhead, he did not place Lord Prajumna's name in this verse.
Nimesha Bhagavatam 1323, quoted in section 1 of this Anucheda. The same reason prompted the author of Satpaj Tantra to avoid specifically naming the various Purusha incarnations when he spoke the verse beginning Vishnos Tu Trini Rupani, which has been quoted in Anucheda 1, text 14. Nimesha, the verse credits Mahavishnu for the creation of the material realm. The Sandarbha commentary clarifies that Bhagavan does it through the Purusha avatars.
Means, depending upon what you want to bring out, you'll emphasize that aspect. You know what I'm saying? This means, so, yes? Yeah, this is the point that's being made here. Yeah.
And Prabhupada does make a comment in one purport in the Bhagavad, I think it's in the first canto, I believe so, that, first canto, he says that the subject matter of the vyuhas is very, very difficult for the ordinary human mind to comprehend. And in the Bhagavad Gita, where that verse is quoted, that one who knows these three Purusha avatars will be delivered, it's also established there, they're actually not different from one another.
Mm-hmm.
You see, it's three, but ultimately, it's sort of like the Christian philosophy of the Trinity, you know.
The Trinity.
There really is only one God, but they talk about it in terms of three.
Yeah, three.
And people who are too, you know, mechanistically, logically, you know, have mechanistic logic, they become befuddled by this.
Befuddled, yeah.
You know, what are you talking about? Three or one? Or
yeah, because mechanistic means you have to go from this point, and when you have to finish the one point to actually move into the next. You can't simultaneously have 2 points are the same,
yeah.
You know. Yeah. Like you say, you take you have a person, you have a father. Now, or you have a person. He's a father. He has a child. He also, to have a child, he has a wife. And to himself be there, he has to have a mother. So then you could say, well, which is he? You know, and the mechanistic point is, well, which is he? Is he the father of his daughter, the husband of his wife, or the son of his mother? You know, we have to have one. We can't. How can it be three? But he's all three. So depending upon the situation, that mood will adjust. So simultaneously, if all three are there, the way he's going to look and smile at his daughter is going to be different than at his wife, is going to be different than his mother.
In Chaitanya Charitamrita Prabhupada, he gives this very nice pictographic presentation of the vyuhas as a square. In the middle of the square is Lord Mahanarayan, who is none other than Dwarkadish. He's mm-hmm. Lord Krishna at Dwarka. He's Mahanarayan. And then on four sides, it's just like, it's him, but just as any one of us, you know, we can have a smiling face, we can have an angry face, we can have a happy face, we can have a sad face, mm-hmm. you know. So on four sides, there's Vasudev, Sankarshan, Pradyumna, Aniruddha. Mm-hmm. These are four aspects mm-hmm. of mm-hmm. one personality in mm-hmm. the center.
Mm-hmm. It means what Maharaj is saying here is that we manifest different personalities, but here the Lord, so that's okay, now I'm happy, now I'm sad, that fits also, kind of also into our mechanistic mm-hmm. view. But Krishna is such that he can have all four of those mentalities happening at once, and he does that through four different forms,
mm-hmm.
but it's still the same person.
And ultimately this goes, I don't know if you've talked about this, but this goes right back to Braja Kumar Krishna, and his four is mentioned. It's all explained in Nectar Devotion. That he has four types of personalities they exhibit. So the vyuhas all go back to that.
Mm-hmm.
And if you read what Prabhupada says about this vyuhas, it's so clear. Mm-hmm. When he talks about Dhira Lalita. He says the poets, you know, classical Indian poets, they generally say that Cupid is the perfect embodiment of Dhira Lalita. But Vaishnavacharyas, they say better than Cupid is Pradyumna. And then you remember, who's Cupid anyway? He's an expansion of Pradyumna. In fact, in Krishna Leela, he even appears, it seems that he, I mean, this is Leela, mm-hmm. but he even does this Leela of appearing as the incarnation of Cupid, mm-hmm. although Cupid is a kind of, is actually is an expansion of Pradyumna. So yeah. even Pradyumna himself is making this very, very clear. And Vasudev, Srila Prabhupada says that Lord Ramachandra is Vasudev. Mm-hmm. Lord Ramachandra is Vasudev. So we want to know, you know, what Vasudev is like. He's dharmic. Just as he described, very grave, mm-hmm. dharmic, yet at the same time, very concerned mm-hmm. for the welfare of others, protective, mm-hmm. and totally transcendental. And sometimes it's said that his three brothers are, you know, Shankar, Gaurav, Padma, but other times it's said they're the other Vyuhas. Mm. Just like Lakshman, he's Sankarsana. Mm-hmm. So.
Well, interesting, because as it expands, Vasudev expands into these others, then from Sankarsana will expand the next Vasudev. You know, and then from that Vasudeva comes Shankarsana like this. Yeah. You know, it's very interesting. Sometimes they even describe it goes from Shankarsana to Shankarsana, then back into Vasudeva and that.
Yeah.
Because we have the element is Balaram is Shankarsana. Balaram expands as Dwarka Krishna. So technically Dwarka Krishna is Balaram. Mm. But he doesn't take the mood of Balaram, he takes the mood of Krishna. And then there's an expansion of that that takes the mood of Balaram. Mm. So actually, everything other than Braja Krishna is actually Balaram, like that. So there's that's why Krishna is unique. It means he comes Lord Chaitanya because of this point. Because Braja Kumar only knows being the enjoyer. He does not know what it means to be the ashraya or the worshipper of him. Well, Balaram is simultaneously the Supreme Personality of Godhead and a devotee of Krishna. Yeah, so he knows what it's like to be a devotee. So he doesn't have to come, you know, take on the mood of his internal potency to understand this, because he already is like that. But Krishna in Braj, he doesn't know what it's like. Therefore, that's a unique to him that he takes on the mood of Radharani. Like that.
Okay. May we continue? We just finished Extra Mundus, giving an example of Harry Houdini as a modern Siddha yogi.
So then you are.
Who said, if anyone can, you know, beat the barrier between this world and the next, it would be me. I'm so expert in getting out of these impossible situations. But as I said last time, Siddha Yoga is not enough. I mean, for all I know, Harry Houdini was just another, you know, he was just more expert at hiding the hairpin somewhere so that he could pick the lock. But maybe he did have some power. There were people who believed he did. And he used to go around exposing others who claimed that they did. But he would always be able to find out the trick they were using. But no one ever found out his trick. Anyway, he was a special personality. But I wanted to go back to a point I made a few days ago when we were talking about the Mundus Sensibilis, in other words, a sensible world in which we're basically relying on the senses that are illuminated by the mind, the tejas, the illuminating energy of the mind. And this is how most materially conditioned people view the world. The Buddha is there, but it's in the background. It's become the servant of the mind. And I said the philosophy that best represents this to the modern world is pragmatism. And I said that this philosophy was developed in the United States of America, at least in its present day form. And there is a whole sampradaya, some very famous names. You may have heard of Thomas Dewey, the Dewey Decimal System.
You know, the libraries.
The libraries, yeah. He was one of the acharyas of pragmatism, total atheist. Bhavananda Prabhu, by the way, is born in the same town as Thomas Dewey. Yeah, that's why he read. I showed him the book and he said, "Oh, Dewey, yeah, I was born where he was born." But there's a whole bunch of other names in this list. And it goes back to the very early days of America. So the United States was basically, you see, the United States took, you could say, Caesarean birth from Great Britain. And Great Britain was the home of the empiricist philosophers. You find so many books about British empiricists, like Berkeley and David Hume and others. There are different varieties, but empiricism means basically what you see is what you get. What you perceive with your senses, that's reality. And pragmatism is simply the application of this book. So the British, they thought up the basics of it, but because they were all, you know, tied up in their traditionalism, their, you know, their own form of caste system and aristocracy and, you know, no movability. It was the Americans that recognized the actual active possibilities of empiricism. So pragmatism is just empiricism in action, applied. And therefore you get in America all this mobility as, you know, an actor can become president or whatever. It all depends on what you can do, you know. If you can do the job and get a result, fine. We don't care who you are, you know. That's basically what pragmatism, and God doesn't figure into this. You know, that's why they say it's the avoidance of philosophy, because in traditional philosophy there are questions, there are, you know, basic philosophical questions like, who am I? Why do I exist? What is this world? What is this world for? Where did this world come from? Is there a God? Who is that God? Pragmatism avoids all of that. So it's not concerned with being, it's concerned with doing. You know? Just like there's a joke in America about this point that traditional, in philosophy, they argue back and forth whether to do or to be. Do or to be. And then they say, well, Frank Sinatra, he answered this question. Doobie doobie doo. that's the American approach. Doobie doobie doo.
Basically, you exist to do.
So, having said all these things about pragmatism, you know, and pointed the finger at America, I reflected that. Maybe that, you know, those of you who are not from America, you think you're off the hook. You're not.
Sorry.
Not even those from Indian background. My good friend, I don't know if he's here today, Mahari Gupta Prabhu. I don't see him. Sometimes his wife always comes, but sometimes he comes and sometimes he doesn't. But he has a book that's written by a modern, young, you know, representative of today's young Indian intellectual. And he wrote a book. It's actually quite an interesting book to read, especially if you're not from India and you want to understand, you know, because there's this cultural gap that Westerners run into. especially when they first come in, come to India, you know, like, what the heck is going on here, you know? Why are they doing these things? So this book very nicely addresses all these points, because the author of this book, I've forgotten his name, but, you know, he's Western educated, but he's Indian, and he's a nationalistic Indian, so he tries very hard to bridge the gap. But one thing he says about Indian mentality, which I found very interesting, he says the essence of being an Indian is to be a pragmatist. You know, which just set off all kinds of bells in my mind, because, you know, pragmatism is, you know, whenever you read about in philosophical survey books, they always say pragmatism is the philosophy of America. And here's this Indian saying, the essence of being a Hindu, in particular, is to be a pragmatist. And then what example does he give? Is the Hindu religion. That for whatever purpose you want, there is some demigod to worship. So that's our approach to religion. This, that, the other demigod. Doesn't really matter. You have a purpose, you have a need, you have something that has to be done. So you just choose the one that's appropriate and worship. Business finished. Like at the end of Durga Puja here in Bengal, they build these beautiful earthen murtis of the goddess, and then at the end of the puja they throw them all in the Ganga. You know, puja's over. Toss them into the Ganga. We don't need her anymore. We did our puja, now we can, you know, either we got our result already or we can wait for the result to come. And Prabhupada used to tell this joke about a man who came before the Durga deity, famous Durga deity in Calcutta at Kalighat. And he begged for some boon. And she spoke to him, the Murti actually spoke to him and said, well, yes, I do give such boons, such material benedictions, but you're supposed to make a sacrifice. And generally that means to cut the head of a goat, have a priest sacrifice a goat. But this man was poor, so he said, you see, that's the problem. I'm asking you for some money, and before I give it, I can't do the sacrifice, so you have to give me the thing first. Then afterwards, I can do the sacrifice. So then Goddess Kali said, all right. So he got his money, and instead of making a sacrifice, he went and either gambled it away or drank it away or something. And again he was poor. So again he came to Goddess Kali, you know, begging, I need an advance on another sacrifice. And then Goddess Kali got a little bit irritated and she said, you know, this is not the way we do things here. You know, you're supposed to offer something to me first. And then he said, well, I just don't have the money for a goat. And then she said, well, then at least offer a fly. And then his reply was, well, I look around in this temple, there's so many flies buzzing around, and Mata, you have 10 arms, so why don't you just grab them? So that's pragmatism, Indian style. So even if you're Indian, don't think you're off the hook. Pragmatism is the philosophy of the world today. I just wanted to make that point. And we can go on with our reading. We want to, we're at the bottom of page 16. I'm actually still talking about the extra mundus, which we indirectly connected to Mahavishnu. And this is again a look at looking at the modern application of mysticism. What we're going to be reading about is the Greek philosopher Aristotle's idea of a computer, and see how it's nothing but Mayavadi philosophy, just in mechanistic form. and Aristotle, you know, there's a famous painting, because Aristotle was the disciple of Plato. There's a famous painting by some Italian artist where you see Aristotle and Plato walking side by side in ancient Greece. And Plato is, he's pointing upward and Aristotle's pointing downward. Because Aristotle was the first proto-scientist. He was saying the thing to do is to study this world. And Plato being a kind of idealistic, mathematical, geometric type of mind, so he was concerned about the world of ideal intellectual forms of which this world, you have to study that, and then you can know what this world is. But this, and then we can just mention Aristotle's idea of the soul. He had a very interesting idea of the soul. It's he was actually, properly speaking, an anatmavadi. Anatmavadi is a term that's used for the Buddhists, who traditionally Buddhists don't believe in soul. But when you read Aristotle, he does talk about the soul. But his idea of the soul is that the soul is the form of things. In other words, like we have this saying, form is defined by function, you know? So the only reason the cartels have this form, you know, in Aristotelian philosophy, is because of the function they are to perform, to be played, make a sound. Therefore, they look like this. And that's why an axe looks like an axe. And so that form, Aristotle said, is the soul. That's the soul, you see. And that's why you'll find this very interesting. You may have heard, you know, in modern Christianity, there's a big uproar about abortion. And the fundamentalist Christians, they're always out, they're often out on the streets with signs, and sometimes they even blow up abortion clinics or shoot down. There's one who actually was going around America shooting abortion doctors, because he was saying that, and they're right. They're saying this is worse than Hitler's Germany, because when you add up the figures of how many babies are being aborted in the United States, or take India too. I mean, you see advertisements for abortions on the buses, you know, in the train, in the subways, you know. Pregnant? Call this number. That means you know, abortions are also available here. So, they always talk about the 6 million Jews who died in the Third Reich, but we have an ongoing Holocaust right now. It's been going on for years and years and years. So these Christians do get, validly upset. But the interesting thing about Christian philosophy, up to the time of Thomas Aquinas, the Catholics will call him Saint Thomas Aquinas. He was the one who wrote a treatise called Summa Theologica, which was sort of like the theory of everything of his time. Just like now, there are theories of everything written by people like Stephen Hawking or, you know, whoever, big physicists that try to explain everything, the whole universe. So St. Thomas Aquinas wrote a treatise in Latin that tried to explain the whole universe, everything, in terms of two things, Catholic or Christian theology. Now the thing is the Bible, you know, it has something about God in it, has rules and regulations, has some Puranic history in it. You'll be interested to know I have a book in my collection that I just got recently, written by one of the foremost biblical scholars of the world. And he's more or less proven that the Bible, the Old Testament, is two different books put together, and he's divided them. And so he's presented one book, which he says is the main, you know, the actual flowing text. And when you read it, it makes sense. Because what he did, he said there are two different authors, and one of them was putting in all kinds of Jewish rules and regulations and rituals and things, just inserting them. And the other one was writing a sort of a Purana. So he just took the Puranic part out. And when you read the Purana, it makes sense. You know, it's a very flowing story. So this is what happens when there's no Parampara. You know, that's what Prabhupada used to say. The Bible is not a trustworthy scripture because it's all muddled up by so-called saints and, you know, holy people who may not have been so holy and so wise. So anyway, in Christian theology, up through the time of Thomas Aquinas, Aristotle was the philosopher, because there's no philosophy in the Bible anywhere. Old Testament, New Testament, you don't find philosophy, you find theology. Of course, theology means actually philosophy of God, but you don't really find that. You just find that there is a God and he's telling you to do this, and if you don't do this, then this is going to happen, that's going to happen. You know, you're going to turn into a pillar of salt, or the Red Sea is going to drown you, or, you know, different terrible things are going to happen to you if you don't follow God's order. But there, philosophy is supposed to tell us why, you see, give us, inform us of why these things are the way they are. And there's very little of that or none of that in the Bible. So when so it was actually Thomas Aquinas' task to compose such a work, theology and philosophy. So for philosophy, he took from Aristotle. Aquinas took from Aristotle, because at that time they were getting the works of Aristotle. I might have mentioned to you before. The works of Aristotle were flooding Europe from where? Arabia. Not from Greece, where they were written. And they were being translated from Arabic. And you'd be interested to know that the first translation of the Upanishads, I think it's 64 Upanishads of the Vedas, the first translation was prepared from Persian, not from Sanskrit, because the Europeans had not yet discovered the original Upanishads. And I've read that. And, you know, even just reading the English translation, they're so different. But somehow or other, the potency came through. You know, these early European philosophers got into Vedic philosophy in the 1800s, like Schopenhauer. They were reading that translation from Persian, and still something came through that impressed them very deeply. But it's really off. It's really weird if you read the direct translation from English. But anyway, getting back to Christian theology, because of this idea of Aristotle, that soul is, in other words, synonymous with form. The human soul is the human form. Not the human body, but the human form. He subtly distinguished between body and form. Can you follow what I'm saying? You know? Just like an artist can draw the form of a human being, great artists can do it so well that, you know, if you see it, you might think it's a real human being, but it's just the form of a human being. So Aristotle would say that form is the soul. And he said that when that form, that body, which is presenting that form to you, dies and deteriorates, the soul goes with it. The soul is not eternal. You see? So that's Aristotle's philosophy. So, therefore, it's interesting to note that up to the time of Sir Thomas Aquinas, abortion in Christianity was not a sin. You know why? I mean, I think you can figure out why. Because a human fetus does not assume human form for some period of, I don't know what it is, some several weeks at least. I don't know, 2 months or something like that. It's just, as Prabhupada described, it's in the Bhagavatam, a pea-like lump of flesh. It's just a lump of flesh. So as long as it looks like a lump of flesh, there's no human soul. So in those days, in Christianity, abortion was not a sin. Now it's a big thing, you see. So these mundane religions are, they're shot through with all kinds of contradictions. So anyway, we want to, in the 5 minutes we got left, we want to read about Aristotle's conception of computer. From the ancient world to the present, mankind has tried to come to grips, this is bottom page 16 in my study guide, I hope it's the same as yours. Mankind has tried to come to grips with what would seem to be a straightforward, easy to answer question: what is reality? Today some scientists think we're getting closer to the answer by computer-dependent demonstrations of holographic models of the universe and artificial intelligence. I'd like to just mention, back in the time of Sir Isaac Newton, who was, you know, one of the great scientists of history, because they didn't have computers in those days, their most complicated mechanical instrument was the clock. They used to have metal wind-up clocks. So his picture of the universe was like that of a clock. You see, everything he describes about the universe is in terms of a clock. Nowadays, it's in terms of a computer. And the interesting thing to keep in mind is that Darwin's theory of evolution comes out of the clock conception. And therefore, it's totally obsolete. It's totally obsolete. The theory of relativity and quantum physics have, you know, they've taken that clock, put a stick of dynamite under it, lit it, and exploded it into all directions. The clock mechanism, you know, the clock idea of the universe doesn't... They use it for mechanical things, you know, but they say as far as, you know, really coming to grips with what is matter, it's useless. That's just my own nemesha right here. Well, the rough idea of a modern computer was conceived by the Greek philosopher Aristotle, who lived from 384 to 322 BC. He termed the device the proton organum, which means first instrument. While Aristotle never proposed the proton organum to be a man-made device, a device it surely was, made out of stellar fire and located in the heart of every human being. The body's senses fed their data into this first instrument, and not to the soul. Aristotle believed the soul needed picture images, which he called phantasmata. And you might remember, I mentioned some days ago, there's a Sanskrit, in the Sanskrit dictionary, phanta, panta, which means barren land. So it looks, you know, like something, like land, useful land, but you can't grow anything on it. You can easily understand from that root we get words like fantasy, phantom, phantasmagoria, fantastic. It all comes from panta. And here we find in Greek phantasmata, picture images. In other words, the world that we're seeing is not a real world. It's just imagery. It's just phantasms. It's just like when you look at the screen of your computer. You know, we become absorbed in computers and we forget. I won't ask for raising of hands, but I'm sure 100% here would raise their hands. How many have ever forgotten while viewing a computer that what you're seeing on the screen is not actually real? We've all forgotten that, you know. We all become so absorbed in the image we think it's real. So Aristotle believed the soul needed picture images, phantasmata, in order for it to understand anything of the physical world. But the physical world is not phantasmata by nature. Very much like a computer, the proton organum rewrote sense data into a language of imagery the soul could comprehend.
What it comprehended, the soul unhesitatingly accepted as the real material world. But in fact, the data the proton or ganon transmitted for the soul to, quote, see, hear, touch, taste, and smell world were, ontologically speaking, do you remember the word ontology? Remember it? I explained it already, so I don't have to explain it again. They were, ontologically speaking, illusions. Anu phantasmatos, that is Greek. Without the help of phantasms, you know, a synonym for phantasm is ghost. So without the help of spooky images, in other words, wrote Aristotle, the soul is unable to perceive a thing. This doctrine prevailed in Europe until the 17th century. Therefore, nirvishesha shunyavadi. From the Vaishnava standpoint of creation as established in the second canon of Srimad Bhagavatam, the doctrine of world as phantasm is not entirely without merit, because this is the world of Maya. But, you see, it is our whole presentation of the Vyuhas is to explain to you what it is really based on. It is really based on the personal form of the Lord in these various expansions. And it's only by the grace of these forms of the Lord that we're able to perceive. The material world is, first of all, a reflected form of the Lord, and it's only by the grace of the Lord, for example, entering our heart as Lord Aniruddha and giving us the tejas, the power of illumination, to perceive his shakti, that we are able to see that reflected form of the Lord. So Vaishnavas say the material world is not unreal in the sense of being a phantasm. It is not unreal in that sense. It is simply temporary. Prabhupada made that point many times. So, it's not entirely without merit, because Maya does mean illusion. But these days, some intellectually endowed persons try to prove, using computer technology as evidence, that illusion is ultimately all there is out there in the cosmos as far as we human beings are able to understand and discuss it amongst ourselves. This is nirvishesha shunyavadi philosophy, and whether it is served up by a proton or ganon or not, it remains what it is, mayavadi philosophy. So mayavadi philosophy actually... Because this is the second paragraph of our discussion about, you know, it is indirectly connected to Sankarshan. Mayavadi philosophy actually starts there, because Lord Shiva is the expansion, or Sadashiva is a form of Lord Sankarshan, and he is the propagator of Mayavadi philosophy, and when one is absorbed into the body of Mahavishnu, then one merges, and the sense of selfness entirely disappears. All perceptions disappear. Also, when one is in that trance we were talking about the other day, pragya. You see, pragya, although it is yogic trance, it does have a very strong similarity to what we know as susupti, that deep dreamless sleep that we all experience at night. Because in pragya, although you are awake in the sense of knowing yourself to be soul, you are not perceiving even the movements of the mind, what to speak of the impressions of the senses. To be in the pragya state of consciousness, you are above that. That means you're perceiving nothing, thinking nothing, imagining nothing. And that's just what the point here. Without the proton organum, without that computer in the heart, it's impossible for the soul to perceive, know, think, have any conception of anything. Now I can speak more about Aristotle and his idea. He had an idea of God. I can just simplify the subject just by saying it's very similar to the idea of impersonal Brahman. The unmoved prime mover, that's what he called God. an entity who is just a mind thinking about himself and nothing else, not caring at all about this material world, and this material world is just some kind of accidental, you know, aura or something around him which he has nothing to do with. So anyway, it's time to stop. We're after 9 o'clock, and but that's good because we finished this part about relating Western philosophy up to Sankarshan, and tomorrow we're going to speak about genuine God consciousness, how to reach Vasudeva Sattva very practically, quoting from Srila Prabhupada, and then we'll be done with this. And then we can continue, as Maharaj is doing, with Jiva Goswami's comments on this chapter. Thank you very much. We'll see you tomorrow. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Bhagavatam ki jai. Hari 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 Hari